Welcome to the Highly Objective Podcast, where we talk to cannabis industry executives and investors and go into the weeds on recent news.
My own background is kind of diverse. It's really more of a serial entrepreneur. I've had a number of different types of businesses in my life, a few software companies, CPG. I was one of the original importers of the acai berry in the US, and we got it on the shelves of Whole Foods. So, I think that helped me get an understanding about how to work with retailers in the cannabis space. I also have, a fair amount of kind of technology experience. And I think that's been instrumental as well. So, I think my diverse background and my partner, Keith Sitch, his diverse background in finance and Wall Street, has been a great mix for us and has helped us navigate, this incredibly challenging industry, the likes of which, I've never seen in my lifetime. So
where did you and Keith first meet each other and sort of, what drove you to start Sunderstorm back in December 2014?
Yeah. So Keith and I go way back to college. We're college friends, and we've been lifelong friends for over 40 years now, which is kind of hard to believe. We've been business partners. And I think I always tell people that despite all the challenges that we see in this industry, I still believe that the most challenging thing in business is picking your partners. I've had several different failures in my life because I made some mistakes there, but I've learned a lot. And, Keith and I have a really good way of working together, and our friendship has held through all these years. And I think that's really made, helped us be successful. His skill set is very different from mine. And that's been terrific for us.
Yeah. Give us an overview today of Sunderstorm and sort of your footprint, your scale, and sort of the products that you offer.
We started this company in 2015. I was doing a little bit of self-study molecular biology back then. So I have a little bit of a science background. And when I learned about 2014, 2015 timeframe, when I learned in 2014 that you could extract cannabis oil out of the plant, I wanted to jump into the industry because I realized that suddenly it was more than just a flower game. Now you can make a variety of finished goods, finished products. And that was much more interesting to me, particularly for the medical applications. So we dived in and we started with making edibles with the Connell line of gummies. We also started with some vapes, and we had the first nanotechnology in the industry, where we launched a Sunderstorm Scientific nanotechnology tincture that has been over the years really a terrific product. Unfortunately, that market is really, really too small to really merit a lot of investment in today's world. We all believe that if you can win in one category, you can, you should focus on that category. And that's pretty much what we did over the last few years. Let's call it 4 years. We really saw that we could blow it up and be successful in the gummy category, the edible category. So we really focused a lot of energy and marketing dollars there. And today we're one of the top four brands, I think, in the entire country on edibles. So that's given us really a great kind of framework from which we can now do other more exciting things. And so we are looking to enter into other categories and other markets today. And really it's because we feel like we have a good base from which we can build the company. So we started in California in 2015 timeframe was when we fully launched in California. We wanted to wait until we could become a top 10 California brand before we actually set our horizons on other markets and other states. That occurred in kind of 2019, 2020 timeframe. So we started looking at other states, and we decided to launch in three states simultaneously, doing it all ourselves, or doing mostly all ourselves. So we launched in Colorado, Nevada, and Massachusetts. And those have been our MSO strategy markets for the last 2 to 3 years. And now we're expanding into new markets from there. So we're very careful about the states that we pick or the markets that we select. You know, capital is hard to come by these days. So we want to use capital very wisely. And we want to make sure that when we go into a state, that we have a plan to get to cash flow positive with a minimal amount of capital investment and a shorter time frame as possible. So that is, we look very, very carefully at each market before we enter, and we do the due diligence to make sure that we can get to that, that we can win with that strategy. So that's been our strategy, mostly to date.
And does that mean more mature markets? I'm just thinking about, your home states, California, Colorado, Massachusetts, Nevada, very, very mature states. Or is that not necessarily the case? Obviously more mature states, better infrastructure. Would we see you getting into Ohio or Maryland anytime soon, given that they're a more nascent state as it relates to adult use?
Yeah, I think the way we looked at it and originally was that we wanted to be in the $1 billion plus markets. So that was kind of the initial filter. We looked at that some of the mature states, let's call it Nevada and Colorado initially, because we felt like we could make good progress there. We also felt like Nevada was a market where you kind of have to be in Nevada if you're building a national brand, because there's so much tourism, people from all over the country. And that really is a marketing play as much as it is a revenue play. We had some opportunity in Colorado. We thought that we could be very successful there. In fact, to be honest, we found that market much more challenging than we had anticipated. So we learned a lot along the way. And I don't think it's one of our bigger markets. It's definitely not one of our bigger markets today. So we'd rather focus on, elsewhere where we could really make hay. Massachusetts has been a great market for us. I don't think it's a mature market, even though it's been around for a while. It's really, we entered that market as it was really heading into its recreational stride. And I think we timed it perfectly. And now we're one of the top brands in the state. We're very proud of that market. We have a great gross margin in that market. We're very profitable and we have a good partner. And, that's helped us to learn a lot along the way. I think the partnerships have been, I think one of the big lessons we've learned is having the right partners is really valuable.
And what does the right partner look like?
Yeah, I think that's different for everybody, right? We've decided that we really don't want to do licensing deals. We are very proud of the quality of our products. And, we are firm believers that the definition of a brand is nothing more than trust between you and the consumer, right? In order to maintain that trust, you got to have consistency in your products. You got to have high quality products, and you've got to answer to the consumers when they have questions or challenges or there are issues, which we all know happen all the time in this industry. You've got to manage through that quickly. And we really feel like the only way to do that is to do these things, most of it ourselves, right? Where we do the manufacturing, we guarantee the quality, we know that it's safe, blah, blah, blah. Now, in Colorado, we attempted to do it all ourselves, go it alone. We bought a license, we did it all ourselves. And I think that was more challenging than we had anticipated. Whereas in Nevada and in Massachusetts, we fell under the licenses of our partners. And I think, in both states, we've worked really great deals where our partners focus on what they do best and we focus on what we do best, right? So there's some shared costs. In Massachusetts, we have a little bit of shared costs on the sales front. But we handle all of our own marketing. We do all the manufacturing. Our partner does the fulfillment. And something similar in Nevada, where our partner does the fulfillment piece and the compliance piece. And we do the sales and marketing and manufacturing. So I think the definition of a good partner is one where you know there's going to be challenges. You know there's always going to be hiccups, and you manage through, you make sure that the lines of communication are always open, and that you work together to solve the challenges and solve the problems, right? And I think in both cases, in both of those cases, we definitely have great partners in those regards. And we also found that our partners are local, right? They're on the ground, they have relationships, they want to exploit those relationships, or maybe that's the wrong word, maybe leverage those relationships to help us get an understanding of a particular market, to help us get into certain retailers, and to build relationships as needed. And we also structured the deals so that we were in the canoe together, right? We're both paddling upstream together, and we're one part where our interests are as aligned as they possibly can be. And I think that's one of the most important things, is to think through the relationship very carefully while you're structuring it, and discuss today, tomorrow, and the future, so that you understand what your partner's interests are and align them the best you can. And I think we've done a good job of that. And that's really helped us to manage through the challenges and make sure that our partners win when we win. And that alignment, I think, is crucial.
Yeah, so if I take a look at your competitors, right, it's probably Wana, Kiva, and Wild. So you kind of have Wana taking the strategy where they partner with Canopy-related companies for expansion here in the U.S. So whether that's TerrAscend or Acreage, Kiva has a bit of diversity in its partner, whether that's strong single-state operators, multi-state operators. I think Wild is a bit more similar to yourself, that it's more of a reverse licensing model in these states. So let's say, exclude, or I guess include everyone, but maybe exclude Wana because they may have a closer relationship with some partners. When you're going into a state, what's sort of the pitch and the differentiation that gets a partner to say, I'm going to work with Sunderstorm and Kanha over Wild or Kiva or any other options they may be presented?
Yeah, there's really two ways. There's really, a fork in the road. There's a variety of nuances, right? As there always is. But, I think there's really, the fork is really, do you want to license and have your partner do most of the work? Or do you want to go in and do, the majority or a big chunk of the work yourselves? And again, we've chosen generally to do most of the work ourselves and leverage the skills of our partners, right? So really understand from them what they do best. So I think, for us, it's really a matter of just having good open conversations with the partners, understanding, what they can do, what relationships they have, how they're operating today. Maybe they just have a license, right? And they're very green in the industry. Well, we can come in and we can help them stand their business up and get it off the ground and accelerate their ability to leverage the value of that license. I think one of the most important things is that early on we found, I had a number of conversations with a number of folks in different states, and I just found that they weren't willing to really take a look at the value proposition that we offered, right? And I think as time went on and as challenges in the industry, as everybody started facing challenges in the industry, there were a number of newer players and some older ones that just recognized that, having a powerhouse brand under your wing or in your facility gives you a lot of strength and accelerates your ability to make money, right? And to build something. And so these types of partners were much more flexible in the way that they were willing to structure deals. And we were quite particular about how we wanted to structure the deal because we know what we can do. We know that our ERP is one of the most sophisticated ERP implementations in the industry. So we want to come in and do it and manage everything through our ERP. We need to manage our cost structure. That's just an example, right? And if the partner doesn't want to do that, then it's not really the right partner for us because they're not recognizing, you know, the strength of what we bring to the table. And so, you know, I think you just got to be honest with each other and figure out who has which strengths, and let's leverage them so that everybody wins.
And you guys have done an interesting thing to work with some of your partners, especially in California, where you collaborate on branded products. So can you tell us a bit more about some of those partners and sort of what's worked well and what hasn't?
So we've tinkered a little bit in the white label side of the world. You know, as California has become more challenging in the last couple of years, we looked for opportunities to leverage our strengths, right? And we found some good partners who were willing to work with us. And, you know, they wanted to have us do some either collaboration products with them or help them build their businesses by providing them with good products. And on the flip side, you know, they wanted to help us. So, you know, I think an interesting one is that we had a collaboration earlier this year with Insomniac, which is the owner of the EDC festival in Las Vegas. You know, they have their own brand called Rainbow, RNBW, that they've been launching in California and Nevada for, you know, a little bit. And they're trying to get into more stores and they're trying to build their brand. And so, and for us, they have a massive audience. They've got a terrific ability to spread the word, right? And so we decided to do a collaboration together where we made a fantastic gummy for them that was really all around EDC and kind of, you know, a product that consumers could buy before EDC and take to EDC and enjoy at EDC, right? While they're at the festival. And on top of that, we created a bundle of some of their products, right? Some flower and pre-rolls, and bundled it all together into a package, which was in kind of an EDC package that consumers could buy. And it was fun. It was playful. It was a great test of the relationship together. They loved the gummy that we created for them. And consumers got a bunch of great products. So it was a limited time offering and all of that. But I think that's, you know, I think that's the kind of relationship that we deem really valuable because, you know, they helped us get some visibility into a consumer base that maybe weren't so familiar with Kana. And then for them, we helped them get into a number of stores and helped them get in front of consumers that maybe they, you know, were unfamiliar with the Rainbow brand, right? And we sent our field marketing team out and we, you know, promoted the products and talked about the brands and talked about, you know, the electronic music industry and the festival world. And it was just a fun collaboration all around. And I think that's the kinds of things that we look for, relationships where we can, you know, again, offer best of breed products that can help our partners, and then they can also help us in a way which helps to build our brand.
And are these things short term, long term? Because I remember, I think beginning of 2022, you had a collaboration with Buddies. Is that still happening, or are these things meant to be more sort of short term drops that people get excited about, come pick it up, learn about your brand and your partner's brand and kind of move on from there?
I think in most cases, we really deem these to be long-term relationships. They don't always pan out that way. The Buddies relationship, I think was a shot for us to you know, leverage both brands. You know, Buddies is one of the larger brands in California and probably the largest brand in Oregon. So They had a good following. We felt like working with them would be valuable for us. You know, Buddy's had some internal challenges they were going through. And so that relationship is on hold for now. But, you know, I think overall, we really prefer to have longer term relationships. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we won't test things, right, to see how they go. The Insomniac relationship was kind of an initial test to see how we work together and see if we can help them, right, and how they can potentially help us. So I think that will be a good long-term relationship for us. And then in some other white label opportunities that we have, we've done one that, you know, that's lasted a couple of years, and it's a fantastic relationship for us, and we're very pleased. And both companies help each other wherever we can. So, you know, I think we like the long-term view. It's a lot of investment, right, to do even these small collaborations. There's cost and time and energy, and we're all short on staff, and we're all short on time, right? So we have to make sure that where we invest our energy, there's a payoff down the road. And so I think we really have a long-term view in these kinds of relationships.
And you also have one with Embark that's coming soon on a watermelon flavor. How do you sort of think about those collaborations with retailers? Obviously, you know, they can choose to have their own private label. Those products won't be sold at other retailers. So how do you think about the economics and sort of, you know, relationship building with a collab?
You know, it's interesting, actually, because we've kind of been looking at these relationships for a long time, probably, you know, in over 4 or 5 years. And we didn't really want to jump into it initially. We actually watched Plus, and we saw their collaboration with Airfield. And, you know, I was very impressed with how that worked out for both Plus and for Airfield. So, you know, I watched that carefully for a while, and I learned from that. I really feel like, you know what, we need to do everything, the brands in California in particular, but you know, throughout the country, need to build our relationships as tightly as possible with the retailers. In order to navigate through the challenges of the industry, you know, we have to work together, you know, we have to team together to maximize the value to the consumer. And so now more than ever, I really feel like these relationships with our retail partners are incredibly valuable and incredibly important. And we're pouring a lot of energy into that right now. You know, you want to make sure that you give the retailers products that fly off the shelves, products that consumers want. You want to support them with marketing programs. And on the flip side, you want to get paid, right? So, you know, I think having, you know, we've run some tests recently. The Embark is one, for example, where I think that's going to be a good collaboration for us, where you know, we've got a great relationship with them, and this gummy we know is going to sell well, and it's meaningful for them. It's meaningful for us. And we've done a couple of others as well. For example, we did one with Caliva, so that we're excited about. So, you know, it also gives us a chance to really leverage our R&D. We have a lot. I mean, we're known for the variety of SKUs that we have, and we're trying to kind of pare that back a little bit, because it's hard to manage all these different products and SKUs. But at the same time, you know, we do feel like doing these collaborations allows us to dip into our box of great R&D and goodies that we have and provide them to the retailers in either a collab or a white label opportunity if the relationship makes sense. And I think we're going to see more and more of this in the future. And personally, I think we're really enjoying doing these kinds of things. We just have to make sure that it makes economic sense, right? You know, we have limited amount of bandwidth in our R&D team. We've got plenty of production capacity, so that's not a big deal. But at the same time, there's startup costs, and you got to make sure that you can move enough volume to merit to make sure that the relationship is profitable, right? But in our minds, it doesn't necessarily have to be as profitable as our core business, because we know that we're going to get something of value from the retailer on the flip side, you know, in terms of a better relationship. So we're open to having these discussions, but I you know, we will not do these types of things if they're a lose win or win lose, you know, situation. It's got to be win win all the way.
And is that strategy helpful with potentially getting into other states where you have sort of a dominant single state operator, whether that's someone like Loom in Michigan or some of the MSOs in Florida that have 40, 50 plus locations?
Yeah, I think there's always the challenge of entering into new states. There's always brands that have got an early start and have made a bunch of progress and are making a name for themselves. But I think one of the things that I've realized over the years, which has just been such a great surprise for me and I'm very happy to talk about it, is that, you know, it doesn't matter which market I go into, people know the Kana brand. Our brand is known not just in the US, it's known around the world. You know, a lot of people from around the globe have come to Vegas or California. They've purchased our products. You know, when I went to Massachusetts before we opened there, there were a lot of bud tenders that were very familiar with our brand, which I found incredibly surprising. So what I've recognized is that even, you know, walking into a brand new market, there is already plenty of consumers that know the Kana brand. And that gives us a leg up on a variety of a number of our competitors, certainly not the bigger ones because they're generally known in these markets as well, but a lot of the smaller ones. And I think that helps us get to scale much more quickly. So, you know, I guess I would just say that there's always competition. There always will be competition. There's a lot of low price brands all over the country. You know, we move into markets where we have a high level of confidence that we can get to profitability relatively quickly. But at the same time, we're also very confident in our brand and our brand recognition and the quality of the products that we produce. So I think we have a big leg up against a lot of our competition because of all the systems and the way we've treated our customers and the quality of our products.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, touch upon another differentiation that I see with you and your competitors, which is you guys see your own distribution. Talk us more about that decision to do so. How big is the distribution footprint today? Is it still a heavy majority of dispensaries in California, or is it less given sort of some of the payment issues we've been hearing about?
Yeah. So when I walked into the California market, you know, started walking into stores in kind of 2014, 2015, it took me about 5 seconds to realize that we've got to have the relationship with the retailers. We've got to own that relationship. We've got to be in these stores. This is a very, you know, challenging industry, as we know. And unless you're in the stores every single day, right, you're not going to understand the nuances and the evolution of the general evolution of the market. So I said from the very beginning that we wanted to be our own distributor. We wanted to have these relationships. We wanted to control our brand. If there was a problem, we wanted to be able to solve it on the spot, whether it was a sales rep solving the problem or whether it was one of our distribution employees or driver solving the problem. We want the retailers to understand that we're here to support them, and we want to make their lives easier. And I think we've done an excellent job of that. So we built out our distribution ourselves from the very beginning. The other thing I realized, and this is in California, right? And the other thing I realized is that in order to be efficient, you've got to use technology to be able to deliver the goods as cost effectively as possible, to understand your cost structure, and to make sure that you had all the information at your fingertips, or that your teams had all the information at their fingertips to be able to manage through the challenges, the daily challenges. So we've invested heavily into our ERP and all of our systems. We have an excellent systems team here that manages the technology, manages the data, makes sure that everything is scrubbed and the information is valuable and that it's timely. And so, you know, we've built out, I think, one of the best distribution platforms in the entire industry in California. And so I've always wanted to expand the, I invested because I knew that I you know, would want to expand it. And in fact, that's exactly what we're doing right now. So for the first time, actually, in California, we're starting to have conversations with other brands to distribute for them. So we're dipping our toe into that. We just signed our first brand last week, and we will be distributing for them coming September 1st. And we're very excited about it. And I think we'll select a handful of other brands in the coming year or so and distribute their products. And it's going to be great for us because it'll bring down the cost of our distribution further. And it's going to help these brands tremendously because we have one of the larger footprints in California. We have a powerhouse brand that is well recognized and loved by a lot of consumers and a lot of industry people and retailers. And we have this platform which is very sophisticated, and we know that, and we have an incredible team that can do the day-to-day work. So, you know, we invested heavily in our distribution in California, and I think it's going to pay off quite handsomely for us in the coming years.
And was that always the plan, or was that more driven by Herbal shutting down recently?
This is a discussion that we've had for at least 3 years, right? So, you know, it's always been in our sights, you know, for quite a while that this is an opportunity for us to actually expand our distribution. As I was investing in the systems and the technology and the SOPs and all of that, it was very clear to me that we could offer this to other brands and they would benefit greatly from it. But at the same time, it's a little tricky because you want to have complementary brands that work well with the Kana brand, so we don't confuse the retailers and the consumers, right? You want to have good partners where you can solve challenges, very similar to our partners in other states. And you just want to have an overall, you don't want to do too much, you know? And so the distribution business is really a whole separate business unit. It's so funny in this industry. I tell everybody that we run like four or five or eight different, different companies, right? Or completely different businesses. Right. And so and the distribution is one of them. And that's a big challenge. But at the same time, you know, it's a must have for us. Like it is one of the ways through which we built our brand. So to answer the question, it's been in our horizons. Herbal, I think, accelerated the conversation a little bit. But to be honest, we've been having conversations with brands for at least, 6 to 12 months on the distribution front. And, you know, I knew there was going to be challenges for the standalone distributors, and I knew the brands were going to be looking for new homes. So, you know, we built a home and we're happy to have these discussions today.
That makes sense. And you're probably seeing that contrast over the past 9 years of having distribution in California and not having it in the other three states that you're in today, and sort of, what a big benefit that may be to have the distribution, right?
Yes. I mean, in other states, right? I mean, other than Colorado, right? You have a fraction of the number of retailers that you do in California. So it's really much more valuable in California than it is, say, in Nevada. You know, we have approximately 100 retailers.
And I assume you're going to obviously do things differently than Herbal, but in your opinion, what are flags you're looking out for so you don't run into a situation with the distribution business, because that's not your core business, so that it remains revenue generating, maybe profitable, but not something that's gonna crush the entire company should it go wrong?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've been looking at this very, very carefully. And to be honest, Herbal got caught in the way that we knew that there was a challenge. And it's really, really has to do with getting paid by the retailers, right? And so we've been very sensitive to not overextending, not being too far over our skis, and potentially risking the entire enterprise. by taking on too much accounts receivable. So in general, I think Herbal's problem is they got caught between the commitment to pay vendors in 30 days and the retailers extending payments well beyond 30 days. So in our experience, you know, we are either working with and talking to brands that are willing to take the AR risk on themselves, or brands that will work very closely with us to make sure that that risk is mitigated. And I think that's actually one of the biggest conversations, right? Is retailers are in a very difficult position today. It's hard for them to make money. It's hard for them to pay their bills. We're here to support the retailers and have good open conversations with them to help them through these challenging times. And I tell my team, we are here to support them. Like we are in this canoe together. We are in this boat together, you know? And so, you know, we've got to make sure that they survive and that they thrive. All this requires very, you know, intense discussions and open lines of communication and trust between ourselves and the retailers. And as we take on new brands, we got to make sure that our brand partners understand what this means as well. And so, for example, this first brand that we signed up, they were very clear that they said, you know what, we don't need a hockey stick in our growth. We're here for the long haul. So let's work on, you know, signing up new retailers, you know, slowly and carefully and efficiently without taking on too much risk. And, you know, that's music to my ears. And so I think that's really ultimately the story on our new distribution play is finding partners who view the world the same way we do and understand the inherent risk of getting paid.
So in your opinion, what's sort of the number, and let's just talk about California, the number of dispensaries that are sort of good actors that agree to payment terms, actually pay, you know, what are the others that sort of are maybe okay? And then what are the numbers that are bad? And then for the ones that are bad, how do you guys deal with that? You obviously still want them to have your products, but if they're not paying you, you probably cut them off. So how do you deal with sort of that categorization of different types of retailers?
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's a massive challenge. You know, I think, you know, for us, it really comes down to communication, you know, defining good, bad, ugly, you know, really just comes down to lines of communication. We see it all, right? We see retail partners who pay their bills like clockwork, right? Happy to do so. We have great relationships with them. We see retail partners who are not communicative, you know, are very difficult in placing orders. You know, don't want to give us the information that we need in order to make good decisions about how to manage and help them through their challenges. And then we see everything in the middle of that, right? You know, we've sent a few folks to collections. We don't really find that collections does much for us. What we really find is that if we continue to work with retailers and help them through their problems and through their challenges, and they're honest and open with us, we can usually find ways to fix the relationship at some point in the future. And sometimes it takes a while. You know, sometimes it takes, you know, 6 to 8 to 12 months for them to work through their issues. And, you know, we're here to support them the best we can. Sometimes we have to, you know, make the decision to not sell to them for some period of time. Sometimes we make the decision to put them on COD only and give them some time to pay off their bills. Sometimes we put them on COD plus, where they have to pay a little bit of the bill of the outstanding while we deliver orders on COD. I think one of the most important things for us is that we want to make sure that we're on all the shelves, right? And that just can't really happen, you know, consistently today because of all these challenges. But we really work hard to try to stay on the 700 some odd shelves that we're in today. You know, I think there's a huge chunk of the industry that is just really struggling today. They're struggling to pay their taxes. They've been caught with, you know, the drop in prices. I think margin compression has been one of the largest challenges. You know, as all these lower price brands, products and brands come on stream, I think the retailers believe that they will sell more products if they sell at lower prices. But I think what's really happening is that they're selling the same velocity, but their margins are compressed. So if you buy something at $5 and you sell it at 10, you make $5. You sell something, you buy something at $10 and you sell it at 20, you make $10, right? So it's $5 versus $10. And if the velocities are the same, then all of a sudden your profit margins drop dramatically. And I think that has happened quite a bit to some of the retailers and has been painful for them. So, you know, our goal is to make products that are top of the line, premium, and, you know, cater to the consumer base that is willing to pay the higher price for quality products, and know that when they get, you know, one of our gummies, that it's safe, it's delicious, it's consistent, and they're going to have the same experience as the gummy they bought from us 12 months ago.
It's kind of funny you bring that up. You know, earlier in the news today, I saw that there was a recall for salmonella for an edibles in Arizona. So I think, you know, certainly passing testing and sort of having that recognizable brand that's trusted in any state that you operate is pretty key.
Yes, absolutely. And we are very, very particular and careful in every single one of our facilities to make sure that everybody has, that we have all the protections necessary to make sure that the facilities are clean, right? And that we don't have any of those problems. You know, we were one of the first companies in the industry to be Cat 3 compliant back in the day. We have a zero pesticide policy. That means that even though the state allows a minimum level of pesticides in products, we don't allow any pesticides in any of our products. You know, we make sure that anything we produce, we're happy to put in our bodies. We wouldn't put anything in the consumer's bodies. We wouldn't put in our own bodies. So we are very careful to make sure that all of our facilities are extremely clean and that everybody wears the proper gowns and protections. And, you know, we haven't had any of these problems. And I think that's just a testament to the incredible work, hard work of our crew.
I think that's a great way to transition to Thailand. So you guys announced in December of 22 that you are expanding to Thailand, being the first North American edibles company to do so. Can you tell us a bit more about that decision and how that's going and maybe some insights into the Thailand market?
Yeah, I think Thailand actually is one of the most exciting markets in this entire industry. About 12 months ago, the Thai government decided to deschedule cannabis, and they allowed operators to open up very easily by just filling out a small form and getting some kind of like very basic license. So we had been chatting a little bit with a potential partner over there through a relationship that we had in Nevada. They had medical licenses. They had been in the industry for a while. Really good people. And so when I went over there in December, it was immediately apparent to me that this is going to be a fantastic market for us to open up into. For sure, there's, you know, political, you know, winds. There are some challenges there. It remains to be seen exactly how the regulated system will evolve. But you know, it's no different than what we saw in California, right? So over the years, so we're just you know, working over there the way we worked. I think we've worked in California. So I think there's, you know, somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 retailers now in the country. There's 70 million people with, you know, 30 to 40 million tourists. We all know it's a massive tourist destination. And many of these tourists are familiar with the Kana brand. And so, you know, the retailers are hungry for the quality of our products. And the market's moving quickly. I think, you know, initially everything was in kind of Ziploc or Mylar bags. And now there's starting to be some branding and some proper packaging. But We will be open and available for sale in that market sometime, probably, you know, October timeframe. And we're incredibly excited about it. I think it's going to be, there's a lot happening. You know, the cannabis is being sold on almost every street corner. And there's a lot of excitement about the market. And then, in fact, there's a lot of U.S. citizens over there setting up shop right now. So they're bringing the expertise to Thailand that we've had in this country for decades. So that's going to help move that market along quite quickly. And the Thais themselves recognize the value of U.S. brands and our technology and our cultivation experience and all that. They want to move the market along quickly and be one of the top players in the world. And I think for us, I think one of the, you know, though the Thai domestic market is excited, I think it's even more exciting that we have the opportunity and possibility to export around the world. So we are setting up our facility over there. We will cater to both hemp and cannabis in the domestic market, but also both hemp and cannabis in the global market. So we are setting that up right now, and you know, we should be available for sale in both markets in the coming months. So it's a big deal for us. We don't have the opportunity in the U.S. to export, right? And so we couldn't really build a global brand, but through Thailand, I now have that opportunity. And to be honest, if you asked me, you know, 8 years ago, if I was going to be a global cannabis brand, I would have probably laughed. But I think today it's actually in our horizons and we're going to get there. And that is one of the most exciting things for me. We all need good news these days. And for me, this is a big area of focus and I'm keen to drive it.
Do you expect Thailand to be a big or meaningful revenue contributor?
I do. You know, I think there's just the tourist market alone is a massive opportunity for cannabis. The tourists are already flooding to Thailand to go sit on the beach and smoke weed, right? I mean, they love the concept. And so, and it's not just from Europe and the US. I mean, people are coming from Malaysia, they're coming from Australia, they're coming from all over the world to come hang out in Thailand and consume cannabis. And the Thais themselves are excited about it because cannabis has been part of their Thai herbal medicine tradition for forever, right? And so this allows them to reincorporate cannabis, this powerful medicine, back into their culture. So, you know, I think we have the opportunity to cater to the tourist market for recreational cannabis. But we also have the opportunity to make, you know, incredible medicinal products that cater both to the Thai domestic market as well as the global market. And we're going to have the opportunity to sell in pharmacies. So because of the medical licenses of our partner. So, you know, we're in a different camp from most of the players there.
Great. Appreciate that insight. Last question for you. Tell us a bit more about funding history of the company, how much raised to date, and any plans for future capital raises?
Yeah. So to date, we've raised about $10 million. I think which is not a lot compared to a lot of our competitors and others in the industry. We've been very frugal about how we spend our money, so we're proud of that. We're also debt free. Right. And I think there's not a lot of folks in the industry that can necessarily say that. So, that means that we don't have this noose hanging over our head, which a lot of companies do. I think that in general, we're raising a small round right now. Right. And we're actually getting investors to sign up. I know it's not a lot, but it's enough to make sure that the company has the base that it requires to do, new and exciting things that we're focused on. We're profitable and we've been profitable. We were profitable last year. I'm pretty sure we're going to be fully profitable for the entire year this year. I think that's a testament to a lot of hard work from our team members. And I'm confident that one of the reasons that investors are stepping up and putting, being willing to are willing to put more money into the company today, is the fact that, we're one of the few profitable companies in the industry. So I think that's just the story today. Raising capital is extremely difficult. We all know that. But I think this is the moment where capital starts to flow to companies that are focused on building a true business. They're focused on top line growth, but also bottom line growth, right? And it's a very tricky balance. And in general, Keith and I have talked about this at length over the years. Should we accelerate our growth curve by focusing a little bit less on profitability? Or should we focus more on profitability and really dampen the growth curve? And I think we've kind of reached a happy medium where we're investing for our future, but we're also maintaining profitability and we're building a good stable base. And so I have confidence that capital will continue to flow to us and will allow us to enter new markets and make money and build one of the strongest brands in the industry.
Great. And that makes sense. Very few profitable companies in the space. So if you're one of the few, that's already a differentiator that investors will just see from other pitch decks that they're getting.
Yeah. But the thing is that investors have been fed a lot of crap, a lot of hyperbolic charts that where the slope is far too steep and doesn't make any sense. And I think, rightfully so, they feel burned and they're frustrated. And so, even in our discussions with the investors, the conversations are like, how do you know you can get to where you can get where you're going, right? And we point to what we've done in the past, and then we point to all the systems that we have in place and the due diligence that we do on every new market. And we point to what we're doing in the markets where we exist today, and we tell them how we got there, right? And so, we want investors to believe in what we're doing. And in order for them to believe in what we're doing, they have to see how we view the world. And I honestly believe that our perspective and our view of the world is and the market and the way we operate our business is quite different than most of the players in the industry. And I think that's at the heart of the conversations that we're having. It is incumbent upon us to convince the investors of why we're different. And I'm happy to have these conversations. And to be honest, I'm proud to have these conversations because I know that I can show them elements in our business that no one else has. Our investments in our technology, our investments in our systems, our investments in automation, our investments in quality, our investment in R&D, all these things that we've done, are quite different than most other brands. And so, it's cost us a lot over the years, but it's built a very stable company, a very stable business. And again, we're proud of that.